What kind of smoke?
Smells like tobacco smoke.
She noted, I didn't find any smoking materials among his personal effects. That's a lost art. It is an article of faith among homicide detectives, forensic specialists, and medical examiners that the body will give up its secrets. Fibers, hairs, semen, saliva, bite marks, rope burns, cigarette butts, cigarette smoke, ashes, DNA, fingerprints, and on and on. There is almost always a transference between murderer and victim, and victim and murderer. All you have to do is find it, analyze it, and match it to a suspect. The trick was finding the suspect. I asked, anything else?
No, but I did only a cursory examination of the clothing and personal effects. I had an assistant present at all times, and I audiotaped my examination of the body and the personal effects.
You're welcome to the tape when it's copied. Thanks. Apparently, she knew this was a hot case.
What's this all about?
You really want to know? She thought a moment, then replied,
No.
Good answer, I said. Well, you've been very helpful, and we thank you for your time, Dr. Gleason.
Are you staying with the body?
We are.
Please don't touch the body.
She glanced at Harry Muller and said,
If he was murdered, I hope you find who did it.
We will. Dr. Gleason bid us farewell and left. Kate said to me,
Why would a young woman like that want to work in a morgue?
Maybe she's looking for Mr. Wright. I said, Let's get to work. Kate and I moved over to the gurney where Harry's personal effects were laid out, and still wearing our latex gloves, we began to examine everything. His wallet, watch, pager, binoculars, video camera, digital camera, compass, wire cutters, bird watcher's guide, and a terrain map that showed the Custer Hill property outlined in red marker, plus the location of the lodge and a few other buildings that were added to the map. Even with latex gloves, we were careful how we handled the items so we wouldn't compromise a fingerprint. I examined the contents of Harry's wallet and noticed that there was a spare house key in the change pouch, plus his Toyota key and the Grand Am key for his government car, but no spare key for his camper. If there had been a spare camper key, someone had taken it. And not the state police, who already had his camper key from the keychain. Therefore, another party may have removed the key from his wallet in order to move the camper away from the Custer Hill property. And who could that be? Kate said,
Nothing here that looks unusual, out of place, or tampered with, but I'll bet there was something on the cameras that was erased.
I replied, More likely the disc, tape and memory stick were removed and replaced with spares that Harry would be carrying. Kate nodded.
So the lab won't be able to pull up any erased images?
I think not. I picked up Harry's cell phone and turned it on, then scrolled through his recent incoming calls. There was his girlfriend Lori Bonick's call at 9:16 a.m. Saturday in response to Harry's call to her at 7:48 a.m., followed by 10 more calls from Lori beginning on Saturday afternoon after she'd gotten his text message at 4:02 p.m., then all day Sunday, and even today, Monday. Then there was the duty officer Ken Riley's call to Harry at 10:17 p.m. Sunday night in response to Lori's call to the ATTF office. The next incoming call to Harry's phone was at 10:28 p.m. Sunday from a New Jersey number. I said to Kate, Isn't this Walsh's home number?
It is.
But he said he didn't call Harry until he got to the office this morning.
Apparently, he lied.
Right. And here's Walsh's call to Harry this morning. And before that, Ken Riley was calling through the night from 26 Fed. She didn't reply for a while, then said,
It would seem that there is a higher level of concern than Tom Walsh has led us to believe. That's an understatement. I added, the fact that Walsh has been bullshitting us leads me to conclude that this was not a routine surveillance. I think we already know that. I looked again at Harry's cell phone and saw Mike called him on Sunday afternoon when I suggested we make Hunter's stew. Then my final call at 9:45 this morning. After that, there were a few more calls from Laurie. Kate was staring at the cell phone. This is so sad. I nodded. I didn't have Harry's password, so I couldn't play any of his messages, but I knew the tech people would be able to do that. I scrolled through Harry's recently dialed numbers and saw the call he made to Laurie Bonnick at 7:48 a.m. on Saturday morning, then the text message on Saturday afternoon at 4:02 p.m., then nothing. I was about to shut off the phone when it rang, startling both of us. I looked at the caller ID and saw that it was Laurie Bonnick. I glanced at Kate, and I could tell she was upset. I considered answering the call, but I wasn't prepared to deliver the news with Harry's body 5 feet away. I shut off the phone and put it back on the gurney. I glanced at my watch. It wouldn't be much longer before the state police and FBI agents arrived from Albany. Plus, the two guys from the task force must have landed at Saranac Lake Airport by now. I wondered who Walsh had sent to replace us. Probably people who followed orders. I said to Kate, let's look at his clothing before the fuzz arrive. She went to the sink and washed the mentholated jelly off her lip while I took the opportunity to pocket the terrain map. Taking evidence from a crime scene is a felony, but I thought I might need the map and justified it by recalling Walsh's lying to me, and by the fact that I, and not Harry, could have been on that slab. Kate was at the second gurney now, sniffing at Harry's shirt. She said, I'm not sure. This could be tobacco smoke. I couldn't smell anything except the menthol under my nose, but I said, who do we know who smokes? She nodded. We went through the clothing, piece by piece, noticing the cellophane tape that Dr. Gleason had used to fix the four animal hairs. We weren't exactly doing anything we weren't allowed to do, but on the other hand, we weren't supposed to be here. We were supposed to be at the state police headquarters in Raybrook. Also, there's the chain of evidence thing, and anyone who handles evidence needs to log in, which we hadn't done. And then you had the FBI and state police investigators who might not take kindly to seeing us when they arrived. In other words, we were in a sort of gray area, which is where I spend a lot of my time. More important, we had a good jump on this, but now it was time to leave. I said to Kate, let's go. But she said, look at this. I moved closer to her. She was holding Harry's camouflage pants, and she had pulled his right side pocket inside out. See this? I examined the white pocket lining and saw blue marks that appeared to have been made with a pen. Kate said, these could be letters. Indeed, they could be. As though Harry had written on the white fabric with his hand in his pocket. Or, if Harry was as careless as I was, maybe he'd just shoved an uncapped pen in there. Kate put the pants on the gurney and we both bent closer, trying to decipher the blue marks, which were definitely ink and did not look random. I said to her, you go first. Okay. There are three groupings of marks. The one that is most legible says M-A-P. The next group looks like an N, then maybe a U or a V, then an asterisk. No, a K. Then the last group looks like E-L-F. She looked at me and said, Elf? I stared at the ink marks. M-A-P could be M-A-D. I mean, He's riding this blind with his hand in his pocket, right?
Probably.
Then N-U-K, and here's another mark almost hidden in the seam. So, maybe nuke. We looked at each other. Then Kate said,
nuke? Like nuclear?
I hope not. I added, this last one looks clear. Elf.
Yes. What was he trying to tell us?
Maddox? Nuclear? Elf? What is Elf? Maybe he was trying to write help. No. This is pretty clear. E-L-F. I glanced at my watch again, then at the door. We need to get going. I pushed the pocket liner back into his pants and said, let them work for this. We took off the latex gloves and put them in a covered trash can. Then I went to Harry's body and looked at him. Kate came up beside me and took my arm. I'd be seeing Harry again soon at the funeral home, wearing his old uniform. I said to him, thanks for the clue, buddy. We're on top of this. I pulled the blue sheet over him and turned toward the door. We left the OR and walked quickly down the hallway to the nurse's station. I said to the state troopers, do you have the deceased's gun and credentials?
Yes, sir.
I need to take his NYPD shield to give to his family. The guy in charge hesitated, then said, I'm afraid I can't do that. You know, it hasn't been inventoried yet. Who's gonna know? The other trooper said to his boss, I'm okay with that. The man in charge opened an evidence bag that was sitting on the counter, removed the shield from the cred case, and slid it toward me. I said, thanks, and pocketed Harry's shield. The second trooper asked me,
you think this was a homicide?
What do you think?
Well, he replied, I saw the body on the trail before they put it in the ambulance, and the only way this guy, your friend, could have been shot square in the back in those thick woods is if the shooter was standing directly behind him on the trail. Understand?
Yeah.
So this was no accident, unless maybe it happened at night and the shooter thought he saw a deer on the trail. I have to tell you, your friend should have been wearing something reflective or orange. You know?
Yeah. Well, it's not hunting season.
Yeah, but still, some locals don't wait for the season to open.
I understand.
Yeah. Well, sorry.
Thanks. The other trooper also offered his condolences, as did the two nurses behind the counter. I guess they felt badly about the off-season hunting accident. Or worse, about the possibility of a tourist getting murdered in their nice little corner of the world. Kate and I walked into the lobby just as two guys in suits were coming through the door. I made them as law enforcement types, FBI or SBI, and they went directly to the information desk and flashed their creds. The info lady noticed Kate and I leaving as the two guys were talking to her. She seemed to want to draw the guy's attention to their departing colleagues, but we reached the door before the introductions could be made. We moved quickly to our car. I slid behind the wheel, and we got the hell out of there.
Chapter 25.
We headed back toward the center of town, then followed the signs for Route 56 south. The word nuke was very much on my mind. Kate said to me,
whenever I work a case with you, I feel like I'm one step ahead of the law instead of being the law.
I replied philosophically, sometimes the law gets in the way of truth and justice.
Do you teach that in your class at John Jay?
For your information, since 9/11, a lot of people in law enforcement have adopted the Corey method. Meaning, the ends justify the means.
Post-9/11, we've all done a little of that. But this case has nothing to do with Islamic terrorism.
How could you know that at this point?
Come on, John. I don't see any connection. Well, think about this. Maddox has a self-proclaimed history of fighting America's enemies as a private enterprise, right?
Yes, but
communism is gone. Now, enter Islam. He told us he's not too involved in the war on terrorism, which means he's involved. Correct? She stayed silent for a while, then answered,
Yes.
Right. And, of course, you have the oil thing, which is a connection to all of the above.
What is the connection?
I'm not sure. But a picture was starting to form in my mind, and it had to do with Bain Maddox, nuclear weapons, and terrorism. Not a good combination. Kate, however, was not quite ready to deal with that information, so I said to her, Well, Harry thought someone would understand, so when we think about it, we'll know. She nodded, then changed the subject.
One thing I'm sure of now is that Maddox murdered Harry,
or had him murdered. He did it himself. Maybe with Carl.
That may not be easy to prove in a court of law.
Cop killers don't always get to a court of law, but I didn't say that. Kate read my mind anyway and said,
Please don't do anything stupid. The ends do not justify the means.
I didn't respond. We left Potsdam and headed south on Route 56. It was 6:01 p.m. and the road was getting dark. The windows of the scattered houses were lit, and I could see smoke rising from chimneys. The Columbus Day holiday was coming to an end. Dinner was on the stove. Tomorrow was a work day and a school day. Normal people were gathered around the television, or the fireplace, or wherever normal people gathered. Kate seemed to know what I was thinking and said,
We could buy a weekend house that would eventually become our retirement home.
Most people don't retire to the snow and ice.
We could learn to ski and ice skate.
You could learn to hunt and shoot bears. I smiled, and we held hands. Her cell phone rang, and she looked at it.
Private. Probably Walsh.
Take it. She answered, listened, then said,
We're on our way there, Tom.
She listened again, then responded,
We went to the hospital and made a positive ID on Harry.
Whatever Walsh said, it wasn't nice, and Kate held the phone away from her ear in a theatrical gesture. I could hear Walsh fulminating. I don't like it when someone screams at my wife, so I took the phone from Kate and heard Walsh conclude,
You're his supervisor, so you are responsible for him not following my orders.
I kept you on this case against my better judgment, and I told you to go directly to the state police headquarters, and I meant it. Are you an FBI agent, or are you a nice, dutiful wife? I replied, Hi, Tom. Kate's husband here.
Oh. Do you take your wife's calls, too?
I'm speaking to Kate. No, you're speaking to me. If you ever raise your voice to my wife again, I'll take you apart. Understand? He didn't answer immediately, then said,
You're going down, pal.
Then you're going with me.
I don't think so.
I do. And by the way, I scrolled through Harry's cell phone, and you forgot to tell us you called him Sunday night, and the duty officer was calling all through the night. This kept him quiet for a second. Then he asked, So what? I felt that our professional relationship was deteriorating, and that he was contemplating how best to involve me in an involuntary career event, i.e., having me fired. I said to him, Despite your best efforts, I will get to the bottom of this. He surprised me by saying,
If you do, let me know what you find.
I guess this meant that Washington was not being totally straight with him, which may or may not have been true. In any case, Walsh was following orders, and I was not,
which was causing Special Agent in Charge Thomas Walsh some problems. I said, eventually, you'll thank me for my extraordinary initiative. Your fucking initiative looks a lot like insubordination and failure to follow orders. Also, you're spending a lot of time and energy investigating the Bureau instead of doing your job. What's my job? Your job was to find Harry. He's found. You can come home. No, now I need to find his killer. You need to find his killer. You. Why is it always you? Because I don't trust you, or the people you work for. Then resign. Tell you what, if I come up empty on this case, you'll have my resignation on your desk. When? A week. That's a deal. Saves me the trouble of filling out the paperwork to fire you. And I don't want to hear any more bullshit about us being taken off this case. 1 week. I handed the phone back to Kate, who said, Tom, please call Major Schaefer and tell him we are the designated investigating agents on this case, and to extend to us all the requisite courtesies and so forth. Walsh said something, and Kate replied, No, we don't have any new information or leads, but if we do, we'll certainly share them with you. I guess she forgot about finding that writing in Harry's pocket, and us speaking to the medical examiner. Selective memory is part of the Corey method of dealing with the bosses. She listened for a while, then said, I understand. Kate started to say something else, then realized the phone was dead. She shut it off. I asked, understand what? Understand that we have 7 days to perform a miracle, and if we don't, we're history. No problem. And it better be a big miracle. Nothing small like finding a dumb hunter who admits to killing Harry by accident. Okay, that's reasonable. And if we're going after Mr. Bane Maddox for murder, and we fail, Walsh will see to it that we both wind up as security guards at Kmart. This is getting challenging. Right. Well, you opened your big mouth. Thank you for reminding me. What else? Well, he said our investigation is limited to a possible homicide, not to anything else that concerns Maddox. That's for the Justice Department to handle. Of course. I understand that. She glanced at me to see if I was being sarcastic. She could have saved herself the analysis. She said, You were a little rough with him. Again. He pisses me off. Don't take it personally, and don't fight my battles. I can do that myself at a time and place of my choosing. Yes, ma'am. She took my hand again. But thank you. She added, He forgot to tell him to go fuck himself. That was implied. John, I think he's frightened. I thought about that and replied, I think you're right. And you forgot to tell him what we found at the morgue. She said, I was just about to when he hung up on me. Fuck him. We drove in silence a while, south on Route 56. My mind kept flashing back to Harry lying dead and naked in the morgue, and I felt sick to my stomach. A good life snuffed out, just like that, because he saw or heard something he wasn't supposed to see or hear. I was beyond angry. I was filled with homicidal rage against whoever did this to Harry. But I had to keep my cool and work the case until I was sure I had the killer. Then, payback. We passed through Colton, then South Colton. Rudy's gas station was closed, and I hoped he was on his way to his master's mansion, peeing his pants en route. I saw the sign welcoming us to Adirondack State Park, and very quickly the trees got bigger and thicker, and the road got darker. After a few minutes, I said to Kate, Murder is what we see, but there's something else going on that we don't see. She didn't reply for a while, then asked, Such as? The only thing Maddox accomplished by staging a hunting accident away from his property was to buy time.
Time to hide evidence.
No. Eventually, everything points back to Maddox anyway. If buying a little time is what he accomplished, then that's all he wanted.
Okay, but why?
I explained, Bane Maddox does not engage in stupid or reckless acts. The only way it makes sense for him to kill a federal agent whom the FBI knows was on or near his property is if the murder and the subsequent investigation did not concern him. And the only way that makes sense is if something else is going to happen soon, which is a lot more important to Bane Maddox than being a murder suspect. I glanced at her. So what could that be?
All right. I get it.
I know you do. Say it.
Nuke.
Yeah, I think this guy has a nuclear weapon. That's what Harry was saying. That's what I believe.
But why? What?
I don't know. Maybe he's going to nuke Baghdad, Damascus, Tehran.
I think that's a stretch, John.
We need more information. More evidence. Right. We might get that sooner than we think. She didn't reply.
Chapter 26.
It was dark when we reached the hamlet of Raybrook, which was close to the airport where we'd landed that morning. Close as it was, we'd taken the long way to get there and discovered things on our journey that were not even on our radar screen at 9 a.m. when we entered 26 Federal Plaza. And that was the way some days went in this business. Most days were uneventful. Some days, like September 11th, 2001, turned on a dime. Today, Columbus Day, I lost a friend, got into a pissing match with the boss, and met a nut job who might be planning a nuclear surprise. Next Columbus Day, if there is one, I'll go to a Yankee playoff game. We found the regional state police headquarters and troop barracks at the edge of town, and I pulled into the parking lot. I asked Kate, are we official, visitor, or morally handicapped?
Look for persona non grata.
I couldn't find such a space, so I parked in official parking. We got out and walked toward the large, modern brick-and-cedar building. A sign over the front doors said, Troop B, New York State Troopers. We entered the lobby and identified ourselves to the duty sergeant, who seemed to be expecting us. In fact, he'd probably been expecting us all day. He called Major Schaefer on the intercom and asked us to wait. There were a few troopers coming and going, dressed in their gray military-style jackets, belted at the waist with a cross strap and holster, and wearing their Smokey the Bear hats. These outfits looked like they hadn't changed since Teddy Roosevelt was governor of New York. I also noticed that all these guys, and even the women, were tall, and I asked Kate, do you think they breed them? The place had all the spit and polish of the paramilitary organization that it was, and the only thing it had in common with an NYPD precinct house was a no-smoking sign. There was a stack of brochures on a side table, and Kate, who can't resist informative brochures, took one and read aloud to me, Troop B is the northernmost troop, and they patrol the largest geographic area of all the troops, 8,091 square miles, which includes the most sparsely populated counties in the state, marked by great distances and long winters. Are they bragging or complaining? She read on, patrolling the North Country fosters a special brand of self-reliance, and B troopers are renowned for their ability to handle any situation with minimum assistance. The word is minimal. Minimal assistance. Does that mean we're not welcome?
Probably, if you're going to correct their grammar.
She continued reading, in addition to such typical tasks as investigating accidents and crimes, interstate patrol, and special Canadian border details,
They often find themselves called on to search for lost hikers, evacuate injured campers, rescue storm-stranded travelers, investigate fish and wildlife law violations, and respond to domestic disputes and criminal complaints in remote locations. But can they walk a beat in the South Bronx? Before she could think of a smart reply, a tall, rugged-looking guy in a gray civilian suit came into the lobby and introduced himself. Hank Schaefer. We all shook hands, and he said, "Sorry about Detective Mueller. I understand you were friends." I replied, "We are. Well, really sorry." He didn't seem to have much else to say, and I noticed that Schaefer hadn't met us in his office. There's always this problem of turf intrusion, jurisdiction, pecking order, and so forth, but Kate handled it well by saying, "Our instructions are to assist you in any way possible. Is there anything we can do?" He informed us, "Your guy Walsh in New York seemed to think you were off the case." I said, "FBI Special Agent in Charge Walsh has rethought that. He should have called you. The prick. So you can call him or you can believe me. Well, you guys work it out. If you'd like, I can have a trooper drive you to the morgue." He didn't seem to know that we'd been there, done that. I said to him, "Look, Major, I understand this is your show, and you're not happy about having a dead federal agent on your hands, and you've probably heard more than you want to hear from New York, Albany, and maybe Washington. We're not here to make your life more difficult. We're here to help, and to exchange information." I added, "I have a dead friend lying in the morgue." Schaefer thought about that and said, "You look like you could use a cup of coffee. Follow me." We went down a long hallway and entered a large cafeteria. There were a dozen or so uniformed and civilian-attired men and women scattered around, and Schaefer found an empty table in a corner. We sat, and he said, "This is unofficial, in the open. Coffee, courtesy, condolences, and no papers on the table." "Understood." Schaefer seemed like a straight guy who would extend a professional courtesy, if for no other reason than to see what he could get in return. I got right to the point. "Looks like an accident, smells like a homicide." He gave a slight nod and asked me, "Who would want to kill this man?" I'm thinking Bane Maddox. "You know him?" He looked appropriately shocked, then asked me, "Yeah, but why?" "You know that Detective Mueller was here on assignment at the Custer Hill Club." "Yeah, I found out after he went missing and the feds needed help finding him." He advised both of us, "It would be nice if I knew about these things ahead of time. You know, sort of a courtesy. Like, this is my jurisdiction." I replied, "I won't argue with you about that. Look, you're not the people I need to complain to. But every time I get mixed up with the FBI," he glanced at Kate and continued, "I feel like I'm getting snowed." "Right. Me too. You understand that beneath my federal credentials, I'm just a cop at heart." "Yeah, but let me tell you, the NYPD I've worked with are no treat either." My loyal wife smiled and said, "John and I are actually married, so I'll second that." Schaefer almost smiled back. "So, tell me what Harry Mueller was supposed to be doing on the Custer Hill property." I replied, "Surveillance. There was a gathering there this weekend, and he was supposed to photograph arriving guests and get plate numbers." "Why?" "I don't know. But I can tell you that the Justice Department is interested in Mr. Maddox and his friends. Didn't anyone tell you any of this?" "Not much. I got the national security baloney." "Baloney? Was that like bullshit? Maybe this guy didn't swear." I made a mental note to watch my language. I said, "The feds are full of baloney, and they're great at snow jobs, but between you and me, there may actually be a national security angle here." "Yeah? Like what?"
I have no idea. And to be honest, this is what we call sensitive material, and unless you have a need to know, I can't tell you. I wasn't sure if he appreciated the honesty or not, so I blew a little snow at him and said, I fully understand that your troop has a huge area to patrol, like 8,000 square miles, and that you're pretty self-reliant and you need minimum assistance from the outside. Kate kicked me under the table as I went on with my snow job, concluding, we're here to help if you need our help, which I don't think you do. But we really need your help, your expertise, and your resources. I had more bullshit if I needed it, but Major Schaefer seemed to sense that I was snowing him. Nevertheless, he said, okay, coffee? Sounds good. He motioned for us to stay seated and went off to the coffee bar. Kate said to me, you are so full of BS. That's not true. I speak from the heart. You speak from a public relations handout that I just read to you and that you made fun of. Oh, is that where I heard that? She rolled her eyes, then said to me, he doesn't seem to know much, and if he does, he's not sharing. He's just a little irritated because the FBI is snowing him. And by the way, he doesn't swear, so watch your language. My language? Maybe he doesn't swear in front of women. I have an idea. He might open up more without a lady FBI agent present. Why don't you excuse yourself? Why don't you excuse yourself? Come on. Schaefer returned to the table with a coffee tray and sat. Kate stood reluctantly and said, I need to make some calls. Be back in 10 minutes. She left. Schaefer poured 2 coffees from a steel pitcher into porcelain mugs. He said to me, okay, tell me why you think Bane Maddox, a solid citizen with $1 billion in the bank, and who is probably a registered Republican, killed a federal agent. I sensed that Major Schaefer did not share my suspicion. Well, it's just a hunch. Can you do better than that? Not really. I'm basing this suspicion on the fact that I believe Maddox was the last person to see Harry alive. He informed me, I was the last person to see my mother-in-law alive before she slipped on the ice and fractured her skull. I wanted to question him further about that, but I said, I was a homicide detective, and you just develop a sense for these things. I told him, Kate and I went to the Custer Hill Club and spoke to this guy Maddox. Yeah? And? He's slick. Have you met him? A few times. I actually went hunting with him once. No kidding. He wants to keep a good relationship with the state and local police, like a lot of the rich people up here. Makes their lives easier and safer. Right. But this guy's got his own army. Yeah. And he doesn't hire any moonlighting or retired cops, which is what most of the rich do. His men are not local and not involved in law enforcement. And this is a little unusual for somebody who wants to stay tight with the police. I nodded and said, that whole place seems a little unusual. Yeah, but they don't cause us any problems and they keep to themselves. The local police get a few calls a year to pick up a trespasser or a poacher who's cut through the fence and been detained, but Maddox has never pressed charges. Nice guy. Apropos of Harry, I said, maybe he kills people who see something they're not supposed to see. Any missing persons? Suspicious accidents? Are those serious questions? Yeah. He considered his reply, then said, well, there are always missing persons, and hunting accidents that seem like they could have been something else. But nothing I know about to link to Maddox or his club. I'll have somebody check that. Good. I asked, did you get a search warrant for the Custer Hill property? I did. Let's execute the warrant. Not possible. The warrant was for a missing person search. The missing person has been found off the subject property. Does Maddox know that? How would he even know there was a warrant? Or that someone might be missing on his property? He paused, then said, I was about to call him and ask for his voluntary cooperation, but then that anonymous call came in that led us to the body. Did you tell him about the missing person? I did. So let's execute the warrant. Major Schaefer reminded me the person has been found. I thought he might buy into my philosophy, so I said, the law sometimes gets in the way of truth and justice. Not under my command, detective. He added, now that you told him about the missing person, I'll have someone call to inform him that the person has been found. I was sure this guy had once been an Eagle Scout, and I didn't want to highlight the differences between a New York City cop and a state trooper, so I said, well, we need to think of something to take to a judge for a new search warrant. What we need is a link between the body found in the state park and the Custer Hill Club. Without such a link, I can't ask the DA to ask a judge for a search warrant. He inquired, do you have any proof that Detective Mueller had actually been on the property? Not conclusive. Well then, there's no link. Well, we have the anonymous phone call about the body. Anonymous is suspicious. Also, there's strong circumstantial evidence that Harry was on the property. Like what? Like that was his assignment. I explained about the phone call at 7:48 a.m. on Saturday, Harry's proximity to the property, the suspiciously distant location of his camper from the subject property, and other circumstances that I stretched a little. Schaefer listened, then shrugged. Not enough to place Bane Maddox under suspicion, and not enough for me to ask for a search warrant. Think about it. I had no doubt that the FBI would eventually get a federal judge to issue a warrant, but that might come too late. It appeared that I'd have to issue myself a midnight warrant, meaning breaking and entering. I hadn't done that in a while, and it could be fun, except for Maddox's private army, electronic security, and guard dogs. Schaefer asked me, "What do you think you'd find on that property?" I don't know. Judges don't like fishing expeditions. Think of something you're looking for. Did you see anything on his property or in his house that I can take to the DA? I saw more security than the president has at his ranch. That's not illegal. Right. Well, I think we just need to work the case. I suggested, why don't you stake out the property? What am I looking for? People coming and going, including Maddox. I reminded him, you don't need permission to do a surveillance. Only suspicion. Thanks for the tip. Yeah, well, the only suspicion I have is what you're telling me. He thought a moment, then asked, do you want to spook this guy? I mean, you want an open surveillance or a clandestine surveillance? Clandestine. Like tree cutters watching the road and the perimeter. Okay. But I need to notify and coordinate that with the county police, and I have to tell you, I think Maddox has friends in the sheriff's office. I considered that, and it seemed as though Mr. Bane Maddox, lord of the manor, had his tentacles out into the hinterlands, as witnessed by Rudy's call to the Custer Hill Club. I asked Schaefer, does Maddox also have friends in this office? He replied without hesitation, not under my command. Right, but how would he know? If you think someone in the sheriff's office is too chummy with Maddox, it seems to me that you could in good conscience run a surveillance without notifying the sheriff. Nope. I need to solve the problem with the sheriff, not add to the problem. You're absolutely right. We weren't even on the same planet. Major Schaefer ran a clean, tight ship, which was nice, but not convenient at the moment. We really need that surveillance. I'll see what I can do. Great. I belatedly informed him, Kate and I went to the morgue before we came here. He seemed surprised, then asked, Did you discover anything new? I spoke to the medical examiner, Dr. Gleason. You should talk to her. I intend to. Meanwhile, what did she say? Well, it appears that Detective Mueller was subject to some physical abuse before death. He processed that, then asked me, What sort of physical abuse? I'm not an ME, I added, not quite truthfully. I was just there to make the positive ID and say farewell. He nodded. I'll speak to her tonight. I told him, She found what appears to be rug fibers and dog hairs. I explained to him what Dr. Gleason had discovered, then said, If they don't match the rug in his camper, they may match a rug at the Custer Hill Lodge. Harry didn't own a dog. All right. If we do get a search warrant, we'll check that out. Major Schaefer had long-range plans for what was going to be, for him, a short investigation, so I informed him, You're going to wind up sharing this case with the FBI, and they don't like to share, and they don't play well with others. He reminded me, Murder, even of a federal agent, is a state crime, not a federal crime. I know that, Major. And ultimately, there may be a state trial for murder. But the FBI will be investigating an assault on a federal agent, which is a federal crime. The net result is the same. They're going to be all over this place and this case very soon. It's still my case, Major Schaefer said. Right. This was like the local baron telling the invading army that they were trespassing on his land. I said, For instance, Dr. Gleason is not doing the autopsy. The body is being transported to New York City. They can't do that. Major, they can do whatever the hell they want. They have two magic words, national security. And when they use those magic words, the state and local police are turned into... I was going to say puppy dogs, but that would piss him off, so I said, Stone. He stared at me, then said, We'll see. Right. Good luck. What is your actual status on this case? He asked. I have 7 days to crack it. How did you get a whole 7 days? I made a bet with Tom Walsh. What's the bet? I bet my job. And your wife? No, I didn't bet her. I mean, did she bet her job? No, she's career FBI. She has to shoot a supervisor before her job is in jeopardy. He forced a smile. I don't think you're going to crack this case in 7 days, unless someone comes forward. Probably not. Are you hiring? He smiled again, then said, I think you're past hiring age for the state police. But the local police are always looking for experienced people from the city. He added, You'd love it up here. Oh, I know I would. I feel like a new man already. I changed the subject. Where'd you go hunting with Maddox? On his property. See anything? Yeah. Trees. We met at his house. Big place. Then we went out for deer. 6 guys. Me, him, one of my sergeants, and 3 of his friends from the city. He added, Lunch was catered in the woods. Drinks back at the lodge. Did you see anything unusual? No. Did you? No, I replied. Except all that security. I asked him, Did you see the perimeter fence? Only got a glimpse of it. It's surrounded with floodlights, like a prison camp, except these floods are on motion sensors. Also, Maddox has his own cellular relay tower. Why? He's rich. Right. When was this hunting party? I asked. 2 seasons back. Like, hunting seasons? Yeah. Up here we have hunting season. Ski season. Mud, flood, and fly season. Then fishing season. When I left the city, it was the opera and ballet season. A guy could really keep busy up here. Yeah, if you like the outdoors. I love the outdoors. By the way, I saw a map of the Custer Hill property, and I saw some outbuildings away from the lodge. What are those buildings? He thought a moment, then said, Well, I know one of them is a bunkhouse. You know, for the guards. There's also a big barn-like building for all his vehicles. Then there's a generator building.
Electric generator?
Yeah, 3 diesel generators. What's that all about?
You can lose power in the ice storms. Most people have some sort of generator backup.
Right. You've seen these generators?
No. They're in a stone building. He informed me, the guy in Potsdam who services the emergency generator here also services the ones at the Custer Hill Club.
I recalled the 3 heavy cables I saw on the utility poles on Maddox's property. Why would this lodge need all that juice?
He thought about that, then replied, I'm not sure how much power each generator puts out, and I assume 1 or 2 are backups if one fails. But you raise an interesting point. I'll find out how many kilowatts they put out.
Okay. What are you thinking?
Quite frankly, I don't know.
But this generator thing led me to ask him, What is the local gossip about the Custer Hill Club?
He looked at me. Are you investigating this homicide, or are you picking up where your friend left off?
I'm a homicide cop, but I'm also nosy. I like gossip.
Well, there's the usual gossip. Everything from wild, drunken orgies to an eccentric billionaire sitting around watching his toenails grow.
Right. Does Maddox ever go into town?
Almost never. But now and then you get a Maddox sighting in Saranac Lake or Lake Placid.
Did anyone ever see the former Mrs. Maddox?
I don't know. She's been out of the picture for a long time.
Girlfriend?
Not that I know of.
Boyfriends?
He impressed me as a refined gentleman, but he had a macho side to him.
What did you think?
Same. I think he's on our team.
I asked him, Do you know how often he comes out to his club?
I have no idea. Usually the local or state police are notified when the residents of a big lodge or a great camp are away so the police can keep an eye on the place. But Maddox has full-time 24/7 security guards. To the best of my knowledge, that place is never left unattended.
I'd guessed that from what Maddox himself had told me and Kate, and now it was confirmed.
Did anyone ever suggest that the Custer Hill Club was something other than a private hunting and fishing club?
He sipped his coffee thoughtfully, then replied, Well, when that place was being built, about 20 years ago, 10 years before I got here, I heard that no local contractors were used. And the rumor was that whoever was building this place was putting in a fallout shelter and 16 miles of fence, which was true, and radio antennas and perimeter security devices, which was also true. And I guess the diesel generators were installed then, too. The word was that strange people were coming and going. Delivery trucks were arriving in the middle of the night and so forth. He added, you know, rural people have a lot of time on their hands and good imaginations, but some of this stuff was for real.
Right. So, what did people think was going on there?
Well, I only got this second hand. But this was during the Cold War, so a lot of people assumed this was a secret government facility. He added, but I guess that was a logical assumption, given the scale of the project and what was on people's minds back then.
I guess. But didn't anyone ask?
As I understand it, there wasn't anyone to ask. It was pretty self-contained there. And it wouldn't have mattered much if anyone from the project absolutely denied that it was a government installation. The locals tend to be patriotic, so as long as they thought that place was a secret government facility, they overcame their nosiness and stayed away.
I nodded.
Interesting observation. I guess if you're a billionaire looking for security and privacy, you might want to promote the idea that this was a secret government installation disguised the look like a private club. That was as good as 16 miles of fence. I said, but now I assume everyone understands that this is a private hunting and fishing club. There are still a few people who think it's a secret government installation. I could see the advantage the Maddox of keeping the mystique alive. Major Schaefer continued, look, it's not illegal to surround your property with a fence and security devices, or to hire private guards, or even to hold a Roman orgy. Rich guys do weirder things than that. Paranoia and weirdness are not illegal. I informed Major Schaefer, paranoia and weirdness are never the endgame. I agree. But if Bane Maddox is involved in some kind of criminal activity, I don't know about it. He stared at me. If you know more than you're telling me, now's the time to tell me. All I was told is that it has to do with oil price rigging. He considered that for a moment, and I could see he was having the same problems with that bullshit that I'd had when I heard it from Walsh. So, he said, you think Bane Maddox, an oil billionaire, murdered a federal agent who was doing a routine surveillance of arriving guests who might be involved in an oil price rigging conspiracy? He pointed out, that sounds a little extreme, don't you think?
Yeah.
Well, if you put it that way. What other way is there? And what's the national security angle? I was happy to see that he was paying attention, but I was not happy with that question. This guy was hungry and he needed something to chew on, but I certainly wasn't going to offer up nuclear tidbits. So I dissembled a bit and said, look, Major, oil is more than black sticky stuff. I mean, Bane Maddox is not in the garment business, you know? When oil is involved, anything and everything is possible, including murder. He didn't reply, but kept looking at me. I said, let's concentrate on the homicide investigation. If we can implicate Maddox, that might lead us to some other things. All right. Anything else? I need to get to work on this. I glanced at my watch and said, I'd like to go out to the crime scene now. It's too dark. I'll take you out in the morning. Can we light it up tonight? I have the scene secured and there aren't any CSI people there, and there's no rain or snow in the forecast. Call me here at 7 a.m. and we'll work out a visit. Maybe just a quick look. You're on overdrive, detective. Go take your wife to dinner. You got a place to stay?
Yeah, the Point.
You're staying at the Point?
Well, yeah.
You guys having trouble spending federal money? All I got out of Washington were some new radios and a bomb-sniffing dog with allergies. I smiled. Well, I don't think terrorism is a big issue here. Maybe not Arab terrorism, but we have a few homegrown nuts up here. I didn't respond. Is that what your friend was doing here? Checking out right-wing weirdos? I can't say. Schaefer took that as a yes and belatedly informed me, about 10 years ago, when I first got assigned here, some FBI guys came around asking about Bane Maddox. That was interesting. What did they want to know? They said they were doing a background investigation because Mr. Maddox might be appointed to a government job. That was standard bullshit when you were investigating someone for criminal activity, but it could also be true. In the case of Mr. Bane Maddox, I could believe he was being considered for a government appointment, and just as easily believe he was being investigated for criminal activity. These days, one did not necessarily preclude the other. I asked Schaefer, did he get the job? Not that I know of. I think they had something else on their minds. He asked, so what's this guy up to? I think he's looking for a presidential appointment to the UN Commission on Global Warming. Is he for it or against it? I smiled politely and said, whatever is good for Bane Maddox is good for the planet. Major Schaefer stood and suggested, Let's go find your wife. I stood, and we left the cafeteria and walked toward the lobby. I had a thought and asked him, regarding these old rumors, did anyone ever say exactly what kind of secret government facility was being built there?
Are we back to the Custer Hill Club?
Just for a moment.
And this will help with the murder investigation?
Possibly. You never know.
He went along.
Well, there were lots of wild guesses about what the government was building.
Like what?
Well, let me think. Survival training camp, safe house, missile silo, plus a commo school or listening station. He added, that's because of all the electronics and antennas.
Do you get a lot of electronic interference around there?
Nope, not a squawk. I think the electronics are dead or never used, or on a frequency that we can't pick up. I wondered if the National Security Agency ever did an electronic scan on the Custer Hill Club. They should have if the Justice Department was suspicious of something. Kate was sitting in the lobby, talking on her cell phone, and before we got to her, Schaefer said, I'm remembering now that there was a Navy veteran who lived around here, and he was telling everyone that he knew what was going on at the Custer Hill Club, but he wasn't allowed to say. This sounded like baloney, but I inquired, do you remember this guy's name?
No,
but I'll try to find out. Someone will remember.
Let me know.
Yeah. I think his name was Fred.
Yeah, Fred.
And he was saying that what was going on there had to do with submarines.
Submarines?
Exactly how deep are these lakes around here?
I'm just telling you what I remember. Sounds like some old sea dog pumping himself up.
Kate got off the phone and stood.
Sorry, I was waiting for that call.
There were people in the lobby, including the desk sergeant, so Schaefer said for public consumption, sorry again about Detective Muller. Please be assured we're doing everything possible to get to the bottom of this tragedy.
We appreciate that, I said.
Thanks for the coffee.
You need directions to the point?
That would be good.
He gave us directions and asked, how long will you be there?
Until we're fired.
That won't be long at $1,000 a night.
He offered, if there's any local stuff I can help you with, let me know.
As a matter of fact, do you have any problems with bears around here?
Kate rolled her eyes.
Major Schaefer informed me, the Adirondack region is home to the largest black bear population in the East. You are very likely to encounter a bear in the woods.
Yeah?
Then what?
Black bears aren't overly aggressive. They're curious, though, and intelligent, and they may approach. He added, the problem is that the bears equate people with food.
I'm sure they do when they're eating you.
I mean that people, campers and hikers, carry food with them, and the bears know that. But they'd rather eat your lunch than eat you. And don't go near their cubs. The females are very protective of their cubs.
How do I know if I'm near their cubs?
You'll know. Also, bears become very active after 5 p.m.
How do they know what time it is?
I don't know. Just take extra precautions after 5 p.m. That's when they're foraging.
Right. The question is, will my 9mm Glock stop a bear?
Don't shoot the bears, Detective.
Major Schaefer noted, you have intruded into their territory. Be nice to the bears. Enjoy the bears.
Kate said,
excellent advice.
I didn't think so. Schaefer concluded his bear talk with, I haven't had to deal with a fatal bear attack in years. Just a few maulings.
That's reassuring.
Schaefer told us, there is a pamphlet about bears on that table over there. You should read it.
If the fucking bears were so intelligent and curious, they should read it, too.
Kate found the pamphlet, then handed Major Schaefer her card.
That's my cell number.
We all shook hands, and Kate and I left the building and walked through the lit parking lot. Kate said to me,
I don't want to hear anything more about bears. Ever. Just read me the pamphlet.
You read the pamphlet.
She shoved it in my coat pocket.
Did Schaefer say anything interesting?
Yeah. The Custer Hill Club is a secret naval submarine facility.
Submarine? Is that what Schaefer said?
No. That's what Fred said.
Who's Fred?
I don't know. But Fred knows more than we do.
Chapter 27. We got to the car, and I slid behind the wheel, started the engine, and pulled out to the road. As I drove through Raybrook, Kate asked,
"Tell me what Major Schaefer said."
"I will, but now I'm thinking."
"About what?"
"About something that Schaefer said."
"What?"
"That's what I'm trying to remember. It was something that made me think of something else."
"What?"
"I can't remember." "Here's an intersection.
Bear, turn left. Do you want me to drive while you think?"
"No, stop bugging me. I shouldn't have said anything. You always do this."
"No, I don't.
If you tell me everything that you and Schaefer discussed, it will come to you."
"All right."
I turned onto Route 86, which was dark and empty, and as I drove, I related my conversation with Schaefer. Kate is a good listener, and I'm a good reporter of the facts when I want to be. But facts and logic are not the same thing, and I couldn't recall the word associations that had illuminated something in my brain. When I finished, Kate asked me,
"Did it come to you?"
"No. Change the subject."
"Okay. Maybe that will help.
Do you think the Custer Hill Club is or ever was a government facility?" "No. This is Bain Maddox's show from beginning to end. Think Dr. No."
"Okay, Mr. Bond. So you think this is more than a hunting lodge, and even more than a place where possible conspirators meet?"
"Yeah. There seems to be a whole, like, technological level there that is not consistent with the stated purpose of the place. Unless maybe, as Maddox said to us, his wife meant it to be a refuge in case of an atomic war."
"I think that was just part of his smokescreen. A logical explanation for what he knew we would eventually hear about the construction of that place 20 years ago.
She added,
"He's very sharp."
"And you seem especially sharp and bright this evening."
"Thank you, John. And you seem unusually dull and dim."
"This mountain air is clouding my brain."
"Apparently.
You should have pressed Major Schaefer more on some of these points." I responded with a little edge in my voice. I was doing the best I could to get his voluntary cooperation, but it's not easy questioning another cop.
"Well, when you sent me out of the room, I just assumed you guys would bond and spill your guts to each other."
The words, "fuck you," popped into my mind, but that's how fights start. I said, "You and I will press him a little more tomorrow, darling."
"Maybe you should have told him what we found written in Harry's pocket."
"Why?"
"Well, first, it's the right thing to do, and second, he may know what elf means."
"I doubt it."
"When are we going to share this information?"
"We don't need to. Your FBI colleagues are so fucking brilliant, they'll find it themselves. If they don't, the state police will. If they don't, well then, we'll just ask Bain Maddox what mad, nuke, and elf mean."
"Maybe we should. He knows."
"Indeed he does. Wait. I got it." She turned in her seat.
"What? You know what it means?"
"Yes. Yes, I do. The other words, mad and nuke, were obviously abbreviations from Maddox and nuclear. But ELF is an acronym."
"For what?"
"For what Harry thought about Bain Maddox. Evil little fuck." She settled back in her seat and said, "Asshole." We drove on in silence, each of us deep in our own thoughts. Finally, Kate said,
"There is that group called Earth Liberation Front, ELF.
"Yeah?"
"Our domestic section deals with them."
"Yeah?"
ELF has been responsible for what we call eco-terrorism. They've burned construction projects to save the land. They've put steel spikes in trees to destroy chainsaws. And they've even planted bombs on the hulls of oil tankers.
Right. So you think Maddox is going to plant a nuclear device at the next ELF meeting?
I don't know, but there may be some connection there. ELF, oil, Maddox.
You forgot nuke.
I know. I'm just trying to make a connection, John. Help me with this.
I don't think Mr. Bane Maddox, who claims he helped defeat the Soviet Empire, is now reduced to battling a handful of tree huggers and women with hairy legs.
She didn't reply.